Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As an industry grows, companies owned by white men tend to profit most.
Folks with more resources, longer histories of wealth, and larger networks are able to tap into industries more quickly and take up lots of market share.
Erica Simmons is Vice President of Equity and Workforce Development at the Solar Energy Industries Association, or SEIA. Her group wants to make sure that as the demand for solar grows, history does not repeat itself.
Who owns the businesses? Who gets to take advantage of the wealth-building opportunities of this industry is super important.
So to promote diversity in the industry, SEIA created a free online database of companies working in solar that are owned by women, veterans, and minorities, including Black and brown people and members of LGBTQ+ communities. The database makes it easier to find and hire these companies. And Simmons Group provides businesses in the database with information about networking and other opportunities.
We have an unprecedented opportunity to welcome more diverse voices into the industry.
So the transition to clean energy can also be part of a transition to a more equitable economy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
To the ease of you, running in the circles.
At the Vancouver Art Gallery, they have a new exhibition just opened a week ago. It's called The Children Have to Hear Another Story, Alanis Obomsawim. Alanis is Abenaki filmmaker and activist who started making films in the 1960s, very early, and she's motivated. Her initial motivation for starting this work was simply that the stories she heard about Indigenous people through the media and through education and other stories, other places that were not the ones the children needed to hear. They were not the stories of the Indigenous people themselves, but you know the mainstream culture, the mainstream media sort of reinterpretation of that, of those stories and of that representation, which often wasn't very flattering or appropriate for children to grow up with. So she became very interested in finding a way to tell those stories. One of the ways was making films, and she became connected with the Canada's National Film Board, who helped produce films she created. But she was also very interested in creating educational materials and curriculum materials for schools, and particularly for schools teaching Indigenous children. And the exhibition down at the Vancouver Art Gallery tells that story and shows a lot of those films and materials, and it's a really fascinating story. I was able to attend the opening on April 6th, the sort of pre-night opening, and that was great. And Vivian was down again to the art gallery to meet with Alanis for an interview last week, and this is that story. The exhibition itself runs until August 7th. This summer, so you have a lot of time for it. And here's Vivian's interview.
My name is Alanis Obomsawim. I am a Wambanaki woman, which means nations who used to own all New England, the Eastern Township in Canada, part of Quebec, part of Ontario, very large nation where many groups lived in different places with a different name, but were all part of the Confederacy of the Wambanaki.
Came here together to talk about your new exhibition here in Vancouver, the Art Gallery. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
This exhibition is the second one. The first one was in Berlin, and there was a lot of research done to be able to show all this work. It's like at least 60 years of my work as a filmmaker, as a singer, and printmaker, stuff like that. And it was very, very well organized and very well researched. Mm-hmm. Big, too. When I was in Berlin, I was very impressed. And then it has come here now. It's the second place. And that's also very touching. I see all the work they've done to put this together, and it's beautiful the way it's... You need a lot of space to... They go by decades, seeing what I was doing, and it's very interesting.
And why did you decide to do this exhibition, and what was your main goal with that?
Well, I never decided to make the exhibition. I was approached because somebody wanted to do it. It wasn't my idea. I would never think like that. But as I said before, it happened in Berlin, and I was extremely surprised that people from another country would have such interest on my work. It was unbelievable. And then, Canada has seen this, and they asked to have it here, and then it's going to go to Toronto, and then to Montreal, and partly it's going to go to New Zealand. So there's a lot of interest that is coming out of from seeing, I guess, all this material.
Mm-hmm. And who do you think is the target of this exhibition?
The whole country, because it's our people, it's our country. And we have nations in every province in Canada. And our people are very much alive and very beautiful and have a lot to give. And if you just think of the different language, for instance, which is very rich, the traditions, the history, the culture, it addresses everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since you started your work or your research on indigenous history, what changed so far and where do you see issues still?
There is such a difference that it's even hard to describe. I'm 90 years old, and when I went to school, it was a horrifying experience here. It's very different now. Where we were punished if we spoke our language, today they're teaching it. They're encouraged to teach it, and a lot of the universities, different languages are being taught, you know, depending on the area or the province, and the nations, of course, and the history. And I know that in general, Canadians are very interested in the history of this country, the real history, told by our people, written by our people, and it's very rich. There's plenty of books that's been done. And there's a lot of films, a lot of documentary. There's a lot of material there for people who teach to use. And it's the time is so different. It's like being in a different world. Mm-hmm. Our people are respected. They're well received everywhere. There are possibilities for our young people to do anything they want. If ever it was possible, it's right now, mm-hmm. which means any discipline. And I would say that it's just remarkable, and we're continuing, and it's more than than hope. It's very profound, the difference.
Yeah, how did you got involved, and how did you start? So you always tell different stories, so I was wondering, what is your story? How did you start with all of this work here that is shown at the exhibition?
I started from going through misery and terrible educational system and very racist and terrible stuff. So, you know, not just me, but you react at one point and you want to change and you fight for everything. And you do things yourself and you influence other people, and it's just it was just a big war. And I think that we have won many, many things that is very different now.
Your work is also education, and this exhibition's name is The Children Have to Hear Another Story. What do you think does that mean?
It means that you have to stop teaching the phony story, the lies and things against our people. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. And they have to hear the real story of what is the history of their people, what is the language, what is the history. That's what it means, and it's happening now.
And you just said it, you are 90 years old and you have heard many different stories. So which story stick to you the most, and which story influenced you till today?
It's not just one story, it's all our stories. Our people are thousands of years old in telling stories. So every nation has something incredible to teach you and to hear. It's very rich.
I was also wondering, how did your work influence you as a person, and did it change you as a person?
My work have been fighting since I'm very, very young, and I know that I influence big changes in every aspect of our lives. And I've come to a place now where I don't have to fight that hard. There's a lot of changes happening, and a lot of people want to help. And I mean institution, government, all kinds of things. So we still have to fight for certain things, but we can. Mm-hmm. And there's no intimidating anymore like there used to be. Mm-hmm. Finish.
Yeah. There's still things we have to work on. So what things do we still have to work on? What do you think?
Well, you know, we have to work on what happened with the treaties and correct them. And in some cases, there will be new treaty made. In some areas, it's happening. In some areas, there were no treaties. There will be treaties eventually because everything was stolen and everything was dishonest. And I think there's a lot of people in power and people of other nations who are ashamed of it. They want to see this be corrected. And that's where we're going.
Mm-hmm. And we're also talking about the future and what's going on right now, and we still have things to work on. So have you heard about the Willow Project and that it's like going on right now in Alaska? Have you heard about that?
No.
So the Willow Project is a project that's kind of tries to get oil in Alaska, and it also affects indigenous communities, and was now newly approved by Joe Biden in America. How does it make you feel that we still have these issues and that still people, like indigenous people, have to fight against such things? How does it make you feel?
Well, you know, it's like nothing new. People have... you know, here in BC, the Tsilhqot'in people just have won the title to back to their land. And so the lumbering and all those things that they were doing against the land, really, against the people, he stopped. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are fighting against those things that are making, poisoning the water, or, you know, deranging nature and all its life. And that concerns electricity, it concerns everything. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to be studied, why and how, and how do you provide for the people. And there's a lot of work to be done. Mm-hmm. But everything is possible now. It's very different than before.
Mm-hmm. And I'm part of the younger generation, so how can a younger generation do something for the indigenous community, and how can the younger generation give the indigenous communities a voice, and how can we make a change?
It's made the change. You sound like nothing has happened. You know, it's the contrary. And I think young people have a voice, mm-hmm. and they're not afraid to speak, and they're not afraid to go study or ask for anything to do in life. That's extraordinary. That's happening right now. Mm-hmm. It's happening for quite a while. So... it's not thinking, oh, I'm going to fight for the future to have a proper school. We're there.
Obaswam, Abenaki filmmaker, educator, and singer. This is her at the Vancouver Art Gallery last week as part of the opening ceremony. And I was able to record that at the opening ceremony. She made a presentation to a bit of a talk and a presentation to the attendees, and then followed up with that wonderful, wonderful song. Thank you to Vivian for the interview. That was really nice. Quite a moving interview. Alanis Obaswam, the exhibition, which is entitled, let me just make sure I read it properly, The Children Have to Hear Another Story, runs until August 7th at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and I hope you can make it out there.
This is Bird Note. Sandhill cranes are famous for gathering in the tens of thousands during spring migration in Nebraska. They roost overnight in shallow prairie rivers. Then, in the early morning, they take off. Within these massive gatherings of cranes are many smaller groups, tight-knit family units. A pair of adults might travel north with their young from the previous summer, along with grown-up offspring from several years ago. In the summer, cranes find places to nest in wetlands and open areas throughout the northern U.S. and Canada. They'll raise up to 3 chicks over the season. Sandhill crane families form a close bond. They typically will stick together for the journey south and the winter, even in large flocks. The parents will often stay together for the rest of their lives. Cranes may even recognize family members from many years ago. Researchers once observed that 2 20-year-old brothers and their mates formed a family group for the fall and winter. After decades, the family tie still held strong. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Not that long ago, meditation was thought of as a mysterious activity practiced by spiritual folk in faraway lands. Today, people all over the world are either giving it a try or making it a part of their daily lives. Let's explore how meditation practice can support people in their healing as they recover from Lyme disease. Nicholas Arsenault has been guiding meditations for several years and is studying under Tara Brock and Jack Kornfield. Nicholas was originally drawn to meditation through his own experience with Lyme disease. In this podcast, we will learn how his meditation practice helped him to block out the noise, turn inward, and heal. It is so fabulous to have you on our podcast, Nicholas.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
It seems like so long ago. I first met you through mutual friends when you were first diagnosed with Lyme. And like so many of us, we just reach out to total strangers to either offer or seek support.
You were the first person I spoke with that had Lyme as we began this journey. And I think I've paid it forward by talking to dozens and dozens since.
Truly. Well, I'm super grateful to have you here. How did you find your way to meditation?
Well, as you know, and many of your listeners know, the journey of Lyme disease is one that can be difficult and strange and a bit of a choose-your-own-adventure. And I found my way to meditation through finding it difficult to navigate the mental health piece of Lyme disease, finding it difficult to navigate that choose-your-own-adventure, and looking for a way to sort of take ownership of my healing process and to turn inward and really to shut out the noise. It felt like there was just so much noise and different avenues of healing, and also a lot of noise in the symptoms I was experiencing. And so meditation seemed like a way to really help me ground myself in that journey. And I'd met a gentleman who became a friend, a teacher, Jeff Warren, who runs an incredible meditation community in Toronto called the Consciousness Explorers Club. And that was sort of my first avenue into the meditative part of my healing process with Lyme.
That's amazing. Yeah, the empowerment for your own health is so important. What kind of meditation do you practice, and what attracted you to Tara and Jack's meditation training?
Well, I've been guiding meditations once I moved to Ottawa for several years with a friend, first in her living room and then in a meditation studio that she started, and then over Zoom throughout the pandemic. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't necessarily have any training besides going on retreats myself, besides listening and being a part of several meditation communities. Maybe I should get some training. And this sort of opportunity presented itself. Some friends had been in this program. They were really excited about, you know, the studying they were doing and learning. And, you know, I thought to myself, I don't necessarily want to be a meditation teacher when I grow up, but I think that, you know, training in this way is going to help me, you know, get through, you know, the next half of my life, whether it's to do with Lyme disease, healing, grieving, parenting, whatever it may be. I think this program will help me, and hopefully I can help others as well.
Do you have any advice for beginners who've never tried meditation before and who might be scared that they don't have the discipline to get through it?
People say, I've tried meditating and I can't do it. I can't sit still. My mind keeps telling me things. I can't turn my mind off. Well, you know, the archetypal Tibetan monk that is, you know, sitting in a cave for 3 years, his mind is also running, and he's also thinking about, you know, what's for dinner, and he's also thinking about emails he needs to write and things he regrets in his past and things he wants to do in the future. Meditation is not about levitating right away, at least. Meditation is about just experiencing whatever emerges, whatever's unfolding in your mind and in your experience. And everything that happens to someone is okay and a part of the meditative process. So I would tell people, stick with it. Everything you're experiencing and observing is there to be observed, and that is the meditation itself.
And to just be grateful that you managed to show up each time. It's part of self-care.
Absolutely.
How does meditation impact and shift mindfulness throughout daily lives?
Ah, this is a wonderful question. And I think that for me, my time on the cushion, or my time in walking meditation or biking meditation or lying down meditation, all of that is just a practice that I hope, and I've seen the results, can map onto my daily life. When I'm standing in line at the grocery store or at a red light or running around chasing my toddler, if I can have that meditation practice map onto my day, where I can get one or two or three very mindful breaths, grounding breaths, a sense of presence, then it's working. Then it's affecting my life. Then it's allowing me to stop and be present and take stock. And yes, three or four breaths later, my mind will be wandering, thinking about the future, thinking about the past, thinking about what's for dinner. But just those moments that I could sit in that observation